Tonight we'll get into the subject of communication. We're going to spend the entire evening on communication. Very important subject. As a police officer, I'm very much aware of the value of good communication. We have a system we're developing now called the X system. And I guess the reason we call it the X system is it's so complicated we couldn't come up with a name for it. But it's a system that will cost several $1 million, and it's a system that will identify every police car in the city by some type of vehicle locator system. It's the same type of system that they use in Boeing aircrafts. It lets the aircraft, through a computer device, it figures out where the aircraft is. You know, you start out from Los Angeles, and somehow into this computer, they let the aircraft know where it is. And the aircraft computes everything as it takes off through gyroscopes and various other things. It computes where it is all the time in relationship to Los Angeles. And it gets the plane to Chicago, wherever else it's going. Well, a similar type of guidance device will be in police cars, and we'll be able to tell where every police car is. The computer will be able to tell where every police car is. And when a call comes in to the station, instead of a lady, RTO, we call them, radio telephone operators, instead of her dispatching a call to a certain unit that may not be the closest unit to the call, the computer will figure out where the address is and figure out the nearest car by this vehicle locator system and dispatch the nearest car by computer talk. It'll transmit a message out in a fraction of a second instead of several seconds of see the man at so-and-so regarding a lost dog or whatever, you know. It'll zip it out in just a fraction of a second because airtime is so valuable now. We don't have enough airtime. Our frequencies are all overloaded. This system will zip it out in a fraction of a second and print it out on a little CRT unit, cathode ray tube, in other words, a television set, in the car. This sounds like Buck Rogers, but we have them already. We have a couple police cars so equipped, and it works. And then, if you have something printed out on your screen that you want to remember, you can press a little button that says print, and it prints out in your car on a little teletype, that little device, so you can take it with you as you get out of the car in case you forget the apartment number or whatever. Or if you stop a car and pull a guy over and you run his license number through the computer, it prints out the information on this guy and whether he's wanted or not. And if there's a warrant outstanding, if he hasn't paid some traffic tickets or if he's jumped bail on some kind of a crime or something, it would print that out, and then, of course, all you do is press a button, it prints it out, you take it, and you've got the warrant abstract. You can take him into jail and book him on that. This sounds like it's, 1984 or something like that, or 1986, but it's like now. You know, we're implementing this X system. Communications is an important subject. But, you know, communications really has a lot of problems, not only sophisticated problems like I've been talking about here and illustrating our interest in communications on the department, but just people-to-people communications, like I'm doing right now to you, like I'm trying to do as I talk to you. Let's first of all define what we're talking about when we talk about communications. It really is an interchange of thoughts, is what it is. It means, in Webster's dictionary, it says to impart to another. It comes from the Latin word communis, which really means common. And so what we're really talking about is the fact that you and I have the same thoughts in common. At the same time, we're able, through various means, to transmit thoughts from my gray matter to your gray matter, where we have in common the same thoughts. That's what really communicating is supposed to be. Now, that's really rough to do, to get from my brain to your brain some thoughts. When you really begin to think about it, it's really tough to do. Just take a look at the effectiveness of modern communications today. I just did a little research and found some interesting things. Here's a quote from a guy by the name of Mortimer Adler. He says, 50% success in the process of communication would be very good indeed. We probably do not come near that now. You know, if only 50% of my thoughts I can get to your thoughts, I'm really doing good. In fact, he says we probably don't come anywhere near that. This guy's an expert on communications. I've given you the citation there of where I got that from. Before we go any further, I'd like to put on the board a little diagram of what really occurs when we communicate. Maybe you've never thought of it in this way before. But we go through kind of a system. I get a thought. And in order to get that thought from my brain to your brain, I have to use some kind of a device. You know, they don't just float through the air. I wish they could. But I have to somehow transpose my thoughts into symbols to either words that I speak or words that I put on a blackboard or pictures or gestures or whatever. But I have to encode. In other words, I have to take my thoughts and I have to put them on some kind of a coding device that I can transmit. Now, right now, I'm doing that exact same thing. I'm taking my thoughts, I'm selecting words to carry my thoughts to you, and I'm encoding. In other words, I'm putting my thoughts into a coded group of symbols that are expressed in grunts and sound waves that go through the air. You don't think of this too much, but that's what's happening right now. And that goes through the air. And your ear picks up these vibrations. That's really all that's happening. I'm causing the air to vibrate in different tone inflections. You pick up those vibrations and you go through a system of interpreting what those vibrations mean. Then you decode that into your brain. And you say, oh, this is what he meant. And you form an opinion. And Mortimer Adler says, if we're lucky, we approach perhaps 50%. And that's when we really are right on. That's when we have a good communicator and a person who knows how to listen and understand, or whatever medium you're using. It's really a tough process. And yet it's such an important process. Just to give you an idea of some of the problems of communications, I want to try an experiment that really I think is going to be interesting. Would you cover your watch right now? Just put your hand over your watch. How long have you had that watch?
4 years.
He's had the watch 4 years. Okay, I'm going to ask you to describe that watch as best you can. I want you to tell us the color of the hands. You might all try this. Cover your watch so you can't see it and answer these same questions, okay? And you might want to write them down so you can check yourself, all right? Would you describe the numbers on the watch? How many numbers do you have? Are they numbers or are all of them numbers? And if so, are they Arabic or a Roman numeral? Okay, what's the color of the watch? Okay, it's a gold color. What about the face of the watch? He says kind of a light gray, okay? Do you have any writing on the face of the watch? B-R-U-E-N. Where does it say it? Above or below the center of the watch? Above the center. Is there any other writing on the watch? It says made in Hong Kong. Made in Hong Kong. Okay, like everything else. Great. Okay, is there anything else about the watch that you can describe? Would you look at your watches now? You've all answered those questions. First of all, were you right on the color of the hands? You said they were gold and had some kind of luminescent. Okay, how many numbers do you have? Two numbers. All he has is 612. He said he had all the other ones, right? The writing, Gruen, is that above or below? Okay, you're right on that. Any other writing? Automatic 12 jewels. You missed that one. What about the color of the face? You said it was gray, so are you close? Okay, we'll give that one. All right. Anything else about the watch that you didn't pick up? It does not say made in Hong Kong, okay? All right, you missed that one too. Did all of you have about the same luck on that one? Worse. You know, and yet here's an incredible thing. Think of it for a minute. Here is a gentleman who had his watch for 4 years, and a survey provided by a research firm says that the average American looks at his watch 60 times a day. And yet, he didn't know how many numbers were on that watch. He didn't know about the writing. And by the way, you're very average. Don't feel badly. In fact, you did better than most people. He didn't know very much really about that watch. It's the same phenomenon that just occurred when I flashed those letters on the screen. We go through a process of identifying something that is significant to us. And we have a way of filtering out everything that is not significant to us. And all you're really interested when you look at your watch is, what time is it? Or what time it isn't. That's right. You're not too concerned about the color or the size of the hands or the number of numbers or anything else. What you really want to know is, how am I doing in relationship to time? That's significant to you. And you have a way of blotting out everything else. You know, we have the same ability to blot out words like we did on the screen there. Two thes weren't significant, so we missed one. We just do it automatically. I've seen people have the ability to completely block out entire sentences because they didn't want to hear it. It was insignificant. I've done that myself. I've been in a meeting where I leave that meeting and we get recounting what the chief of police has said, and someone will say, well, yeah, well, remember, he said this, Vernon, you better do this. And I say, no, he didn't say that. You know, I didn't want to hear it, and so I didn't. And yet I have three people telling me, no, he did say that, and you better do that. You better check up on the notes that the secretary took, because we're sure he told you to do that. No, I didn't hear that at all. You know, and I go to the secretary, and she has copious notes, and I say, did the chief say? He sure did. And somehow I have just filtered out what I didn't want to get into my brain, because it was either repugnant to me, or it was insignificant, or I had other ideas. We have problems with communication. Well, these are interesting things about communications. Let's go back to our outline and talk about the significance and some of the problems. Before we go to the outline, let me flash another one on the board. And when we're talking about encoding and decoding, we use words to do that. And yet words are really tricky things, because words have multiple meanings. And so we have, a person is fast when he can run rapidly, but he is also fast when he is tied down and cannot run at all. And colors are fast when they do not run. One is fast when he moves in a suspect company. But this is not quite the same thing as playing fast and loose. A racetrack is fast when it is in good running condition. A friend is fast when he is loyal. A watch is fast when it's ahead of time. To be fast asleep is to be deep in sleep. To be fast by is to be near. To fast is to refrain from eating. A fast may be a period of non-eating or a ship mooring line. Photographic film is fast when it is sensitive to light, but bacteria are fast when they are insensitive to antiseptics. Incredible. The same word, and we can use it so many ways. Is there any doubt that we have problems with using words? Huh? When I have to take my thoughts and to fasten them on to these weird little things that we call words, is it any wonder that we have problems in communication? Well, we really do, and that's all the more reason why we should talk about them tonight, especially in the family situation. Now, these principles will apply to any situation, but we're mainly concerned with husband-wife relationship and parent-child relationships, remembering that the Bible indicates that one of the duties of the man in his ruling capacity is to make sure that people under him are talking to one another and that he's talking to them. He's listening. He has an open mind. He's getting facts before he makes decisions. He's attentive to the needs of the people that he's in charge of. So communications is very important. The chief executive, going back to our outline, is characteristically a communicator. You read the executive materials, Peter Drucker, or anyone else who is very prominent in administration and communications, and they'll tell you that one of the prime roles of an executive is to be a good communicator. And when they're looking for people who are going to be an executive in a company, that's one of the attributes that forward-looking companies are looking for, and that is someone who can communicate. The typical executive spends about 75% of his time communicating. That's from William Haney from the book Communications and Organizational Behavior. By the way, a fascinating book. I've developed some of the material for this outline tonight from that book, and I've so indicated on the outline. Let's look at components of communication. And remember the chart I had on the wall just a minute ago. We have encoding. That's when you form the thought. You choose the method that you're going to utilize to transmit the message. And you select the symbol after you choose a method. Tonight I'm selecting mostly talking. I'm also using some things on the board here. And then you transmit. Sounds come out of my mouth. Or written symbols go on the board. Facial expressions Is there any doubt in your mind that facial expressions transmit feelings? What about the phrase, thanks a lot? You can say, thanks a lot. And what does that mean? I mean, that really means you didn't want what that person had you do or gave you at all. In fact, you're saying exactly the opposite of thanks a lot. Just in your tone of voice and your facial expression. Or you can say, thanks a lot. Or, thanks a lot. You know, it depends on how you say it, the expression on your face, your total mannerisms and everything else that also enter into this transmission. And in decoding, we receive, we convert the symbols to meanings and the meanings to thoughts. Let's look at some problems in going through this process. Some of the problems of communications. The attitude of the communicator. And here's a couple of factors about the attitude of the communicator. We tend to reject threatening communication. For instance, if your son or daughter or your wife comes in to talk to you and they say something that is threatening to you, quite often you'll completely reject the entire communication. You don't even want to talk about it if it's somehow threatening to you. For instance, if a son or if a daughter asks you, hey dad, what's really wrong with premarital sex? And if that's a little threatening to you because you don't know how to handle it, you don't know the answer, you're probably going to terminate that conversation right quickly. Like, hey, that's something we shouldn't be talking about. Or, wow, if you don't know the answer to that, you better go back to kindergarten, you know. And the communication is just cut off because you don't want to talk about this subject. You feel threatened by it. You know, one of the problems I think we have today in America is that we have kind of the remnants of a Christian society. Now, notice I said remnants. I don't think we still are in a Christian society. We have what's left over from what used to be a Christian society. And we have a lot of rules that go along with that old Christian society. And it used to be, a couple generations ago, that parents not only had rules, but they had reasons for those rules. They had principles upon which they based those rules. And since they had those principles, they were able to communicate those principles to their children. And so the rules were accepted because the children understood the principles. We're getting to a situation now where the rules are being passed on with no knowledge of the principles. And so we have young people in college saying, why not premarital sex? We have people who don't know why not. You know, they don't have the principles. They say, well, because my dad told me that. Yeah, but why did he tell you that? Well, everyone knows that's wrong. When the question comes, why is it wrong? That's where communications is cut off. Because we just have a lot of us who don't know why not. You know, thank God that we can find out why. Thank God we can have the scriptures to look to and to look to principles. But this is one of the problems of our culture today. We need to understand principles and not be threatened by communications. Pride may precipitate a false communication. Can you think of an example there where your pride just won't allow you to be honest or won't allow you to accept some communications? Selfish or ulterior motives or interests, flattery. Sometimes we communicate thoughts and we really don't mean what we're saying because we have reasons for saying those things. This happens an awful lot in business, and believe it or not, it happens a lot in the home. A lot of times we'll say things to one another and even in the home situation because we want something from the other person. And lastly, as far as the attitude of the communicator, I've indicated here a disinterest in the receiver. One of the big problems of communication between husbands and wives is that much of what the wife wants to talk about is completely disinteresting to us as men. Let me give you an example. Recently, I came home after dealing with a budget of $173 million for the police department. It had been reduced from $180 million to $173 million. And here we were talking about millions of dollars. And I had been caught up in the preparation of this budget for weeks. Here I'd been dealing with millions of dollars. And I come home, and my wife wants to talk about a $1.52 overdraft on the checkbook, you know? And quite frankly, I could care less about a $1.52 at that moment. You know, I've been talking about $7 million cutting from the budget. And she wants to talk about a $1.52. Now, to me, that had no significance. It was very unimportant, and I couldn't understand why she thought that was so important. Big deal. So we're off $1.52, you know? So what? Deposit a $1.52, you know? Or whatever else has to be done. Agree with them. You know, we're not going to argue over $1.52. I've just been dealing with $170 million. You know, we're going to disagree with a bank over $1.52. Well, problem. When you have a sphere of influence and a world that you come home from, your wife, you still are operating within that set, that frame of reference of what is important to you at the office. You come into the home of your wife, your home too, and that's her only interest, perhaps. Perhaps she doesn't work, and the only thing that she's concerned with is what's within those four walls of that home, and that little checkbook, and those little problems around the house about don't have enough cream of tomato soup in the cupboard, you know? And to her, since that's all she's coping with, that is super important to her. And you know, it's important for us to shift gears and to recognize that we're entering a different world when we come into the home. We're entering the only world of our wives, and it's very important to them. And you know, one of the things that I see breaking up marriages and causing real problems of communication is this lack of appreciation of the different worlds that we live in during the day. And we come home and we automatically think, just like as you look at the watch, and you filter out everything but what is significant to you. You come home and your wife starts talking about something, and to you, you filter it right out because it's unimportant. It's not significant. It's not $173 million. It's $1.52. Big deal. And it's insignificant, and you don't want to hear about it. You actually get bugged. You know, I actually got a little angry with her. I said, "You're bothering me about $1.52. I've been dealing with $170 million. You know, I got kind of angry at first, and that's when I realized, wait a minute. In her world, this is really important. Super important. Market very clear. One of the biggest problems in communications in the home is recognizing the difference of the sphere of control and the sphere of influence that we come from. We have to understand one another's set. We have to figure out in our own minds where they're coming from, as the saying goes. You had a comment.
Well, you brought that point out that the wife has a problem and her sphere of influence. Last night you're talking about that $1.52. Your boy comes up with something he's done at school. Entirely unrelated to your problem as a police officer and your wife's problem as a homemaker, but you have to keep the communications going. I'm going to get ahead of the story. You've also got to maintain communications with the child, even though it's insignificant. Sometimes that one balances the other. You can tell the wife the relative importance. She might want to totally disregard his conversation because her $1.52 was so important. So sometimes you can balance one against the other.
Yeah, what he's saying here is very true, and that is that I just talked about one difference of opinion here. As I'm coming back from the office with $170 million on my mind, she's talking about $1.52, and my son comes in and talks about something that's even less important, apparently, at least to us, than that, you know? He's talking about, he wants the car keys. Oh, boy, that's something else when they get that age. But he may be talking about something, if he's really little, he might come in and say, "Daddy, you know, a little three-year-old guy, I lost one of my tennis balls today," you know? And you think, big deal. You know, first it's $170 million to $1.52 to a tennis ball. And you've got all kind of different sets you're operating within. It's important to understand the significance to the person that you're talking to and not just talk in terms of the significance to you, but appreciate their interest. So this matter of having an interest is very important. Disinterest in the receiver is a very important thing to recognize, and let me mark this, kind of underscore this thought. Young people, more than older people, more than your wife, your children can detect disinterest more than anyone else. I don't know why that is, but young people, especially from about 10 to 18 or so, They're very insecure. They're trying to find themselves. They're trying to figure out what kind of a person they're going to be. And they're very conscious about acceptance. And they're very interested in reading your thoughts and your attitudes when they're talking to you. And just a turning of the head or a raising of the eyebrow is picked up. It's very critical to them because they want to know if they're saying the right thing and if you're really interested in what they have to say, and they're watching you and they're very careful to read you. And boy, they can pick up this disinterest right away. If you're not interested in their problems, they're not going to bring any problems to you anymore. They're going to try out a few times. And if you turn them off through an expression or through something that you've said, they'll read you very loud and clear. And they're not going to want to bring other things to you. You've told them, I don't want to listen. Here's some of the classic big three problems of communications as outlined by Dr. William Haney in his book. He refers to the inference observation problem. And this is one of the problems that we kind of illustrated in that test I gave you before we got started tonight. The problem of jumping to conclusions. You know, someone starts to tell you something and you immediately jump to a conclusion. And you make your own interpretation and you're not interested in letting them elucidate on their interpretation. Let me give you a couple examples. Daughter comes in. She wants to tell you about the problem she's having at school. She wants to tell you about the teacher in Spanish. She said, Daddy, the teacher in the Spanish class, she gave us this test, you see. And before she gets any further, yeah, I know, and you probably think the test was too hard. Well, no. You know, you're jumping ahead of it. See? You're not letting her finish. This test was about conjugation of verbs. Oh, I know, and she didn't tell you how to conjugate the verbs ahead of time. No, she did that. You know, you ever talk to anybody like that? That they won't let you finish what you're saying? You know, you try to start talking to them, and they start trying to jump to conclusions and let you know what you're trying to say before you say it? Boy, if there's a real block to communication, that's it. That really makes people frustrated. You know, I have a shirt tail relative. He's about a second or third cousin. I can't believe this guy as far as communication is concerned. He'll come in and he'll ask me a question, and before I can respond, he tries to guess the answer. You know, really? He'll say, Bob, how's the job? And I'll open my mouth. You know, I'll bet it's pretty rough. No, actually, it's easy. Well, not exactly. And you know, he keeps on guessing until he gets the right answer. Sometimes it takes about five guesses, you know. And where's Bob? He's in the 10th grade, isn't he? No, he's in the... Oh, that's right, he's in the 9th grade. No. The 11th. Well, yes. What school is he going to now? Well, he's going over to Franklin. No, actually, he's going to... Oh, I remember, he's, you know, and he guessed a couple other places. And finally, after town, no, he's going to a private school. And it really bugs me to talk to this guy. When he leaves, I need an Anison or something. He keeps jumping to conclusions, and he's putting thoughts actually in my mouth. Well, that's of course an obvious exaggeration of what I'm talking about here, but jumping to conclusions is done by all of us at one time or another. It really is. Some of you are jumping to conclusions right now about something I'm saying. And some of you earlier, when you took that desk, you jumped to all kinds of conclusions. And you found out that we're all guilty of this. And an interpretation. You know, in order to interpret, what really makes it almost impossible to communicate is the fact that all of us have certain sets we come from. And we have to take the communication as it comes to us and kind of throw it to our background of experience. If I can kind of indicate here by this circle what we're like. We have a conscious mind up here, and we have a subconscious down here. And some of the things that we relate to as far as communication is concerned, and some of the interpretations we make, we even set down to our subconscious mind. But when something comes into us, we have to do a couple of things. We have to take that word, try to analyze the word as to its meaning by the context in the sentence and various other things that are coming along with it. And then we make a judgment based on our interpretation. And before we make that judgment, we do a very interesting thing. Just like a high-speed computer We search our memory banks for something we can relate that word to. We literally search our memory banks. Let me give you a word that probably most of you might have some kind of a contact with in your past. A donde va? Does that mean anything to anybody? A donde va? Okay, a couple people. Five, six. What does it mean to you? Okay, same thing. Did anybody else get any other meaning from that word? That's what it means. It means in Spanish, where are you going? Now, the reason I understand what that means is not because I understand Spanish real good, but because as a police officer, I had to learn a few basic questions. So when you stop somebody at night, you can talk to them. You know, you can ask them where they're going, where they live, where they work, and these kind of things, and you can communicate. And so I have a basic understanding of that. But most of you, when I said donde va, did anyone get any other kind of meaning from donde? Didn't have anything to relate it to? But you really searched, didn't you? And since you couldn't find anything, there was no communication. But there are some words that can make us recall something from our past where we're not quite sure, and we come up quite often with a different meaning than the speaker really intended to make. So we take that symbol into our conscious, our subconscious is searched, our conscious mind is searched, and we try to come up with something to relate that word or phrase to that would give it some meaning. Now, our mind, our conscious mind and our subconscious mind, is kind of what I refer to as an onion. You ever take apart an onion? An onion is comprised of a number of layers, layer upon layer upon layer upon layer. And you know, our minds and our personalities are kind of like that. Except rather than being layers of cellular fiber, it's layers of experiences. We've all had experiences. And we all have had different experiences. There's no two people in this room tonight that have had exactly the same experiences in life. And so when you take a communication on a certain subject or a certain grouping of words and throw them to your conscious and subconscious mind, you all are going to come up with a little different feelings and a little different meanings and a little different interpretation, and most important of all, a little different attitudes about the subject we're talking about. For instance, if I would mention the word Republican to you tonight, you all would have a little different feeling. Some of you would feel really good about that. Some of you would feel kind of indifferent. Others would violently react and say, that's kind of a bad thought to me. And we would all have different kinds of reactions to that word because of experiences and knowledges that we have about that word. Would you agree with that? Now can you see another problem of communication? Interpretation. None of us really interpret the same thought pattern exactly the same. Tonight, all of you are interpreting and setting values and making sense out of what I'm saying in different ways tonight. You're all relating it with your own experiences. And as even I'm talking, in between some of the sentences I'm making tonight, your minds are wondering and you're attaching meaning to what I'm saying based on some experiences you've had in your past with your wife, with your children, with your father, with your mother. And some of this is being real meaningful to some of you. And to others of you, some of it's not too meaningful because you haven't had a point of identification yet with an experience in your past. Another problem is bypassing. We not only jump to the wrong conclusions and sometimes the right conclusions, but we tend to bypass. Sometimes we communicate on parallel lines. You know, we're talking and we think we're communicating. We're even answering one another, and yet we're bypassing. This is what Dr. Haney calls bypassing. And it's important to understand a concept in bypassing. Words do not have meaning, really. People have meaning, and we use words to try to get that meaning across to another person. The motives of the bypasser are very important. Let me give you an example. When I was back in Chicago, a very weird thing happened to me. I walked up and started talking to a policeman. And we got talking and introduced myself as an L.A. policeman. We got talking about a variety of subjects. And finally, we got around to exchanging some thoughts about some procedures. And I said, well, you know, back in L.A. when we do that, we make out a shake card on the guy. And the guy says, when you shake someone down, you write a card on it? I said, oh, yeah, we turn it with our log. He said, you document that kind of action? And I said, well, of course. You know, we record what we're doing. He said, yeah, but couldn't you get in trouble for that? I said, yeah, if you don't make out the shake card, you might get in trouble. And he said, but you mean, you L.A. cops, you shake people down, right? I said, yeah, of course we do. Well, I kind of figured you probably did, even though Adam 12 doesn't show it, but you write it, you make a record of it when you shake someone down. I said, oh, yeah, we make a record of it when we shake someone down. He says, wow, that's out of sight. I can't believe it, you know. I thought we were communicating. We were on parallel lines. Because you know why? What he meant by shaking someone down was entirely different than what I meant by shaking someone down. To an L.A. cop, shaking someone, writing a shake card, or an F.I. as we call them, is, by the way, we call it process, shaking, metro, they say, we're going to go out tonight and shake, rattle, and roll. And that means that they're going to shake people down. And what shaking down to L.A. policemen means is you stop someone, see what they're doing, you know. You're in a high burglary area, and you see a car that fits the description of the car that's being used by the burglars. You know, it's a blue Chevy 1962, and the car you're looking for is a blue Chevy 62, and they're in the area, and they're looking hinky at you, you know. And so you shake them. And to an L.A. policeman, shaking means you pull them over, you stop, you say, hi, what are you doing here? Where do you live? What do you, you know, what's going on? You flash a light around. That's a shake. To a Chicago policeman, shaking means something entirely different. You stop someone, you know, they're going through a red light. And you come up to them and you say, now, do you want a ticket or do you want to handle this? And the guy with a $10 bill behind his license hands you his license and you hand him back his license and keep the $10 bill. And that's what shaking someone down to a Chicago policeman means. And that's why he was saying, you document that? And I said, yeah, we document it. Can't you get in trouble for that? Yeah, if you don't write it down. And it, you know, we were just going like that, you see? We were not communicating. We were bypassing. I thought he knew what I meant, and he thought that I knew what he thought I meant. You know? Well, we get a little mixed up there, but this problem that Dr. Haney talks about of bypassing is a very real one. It's 8:10. Let's take a break. Third reason that Dr. Haney talks about in his book is after bypassing is what he calls allness. And this is where we really dogmatic about our position. We don't want to hear the other person's position. We kind of go through a process that he refers to as abstracting, where we abstract what we know about that subject and assume that that's all you can know about what they're talking about, that there's nothing else that can be known. You know it all. Once again, we're all guilty of this at one time or another, you know, but your wife begins talking about something and you disagree and you begin with a kind of a set in your mind that you know all there is to know about this. You're not going to listen to her. You're not going to hear her viewpoint. You know, it's really important to hear other people's viewpoints, to hear them out. I can think of a lot of situations in police work where it's important to not jump to conclusions and not think that you know all the facts that there are to know about a particular crime, for instance. One of the ways I used to, I think we still use something like this in our academy, except it's a little bit more sophisticated, but we used to use a picture that we'd flash on the screen to demonstrate how people jump to conclusions and how they think they know all there is to know about a subject, so much so that they feel very content with the conclusions that they've arrived at. They used to flash a picture on the screen that showed a group of people, and a crime had just occurred. Someone was laying on the floor with blood running from them, and one of the suspects in the picture has a razor in his hand, and another person has a pistol, and some of the people are male and some are female, and there are different races involved. There's a Negro involved, and there's a Mexican-American involved, and there's an Anglo or Caucasian involved. And invariably, after flashing this picture on the screen for a period of time, invariably, as we asked the various people in the class to describe what was occurring, somehow the razor gets from the Caucasian's hand to the Negro's hand in every case. You know, he said, well, who had the razor? Everybody, you know, if you'd ask him, the Negro had the razor. And he didn't. He really didn't, you know. You flash this picture back up on the screen and the Negro doesn't have the razor. The Anglo has a razor. How do you think the razor got in the Negro's hand? Huh? What's that? People's minds put it there. Stereotyping, patterning, abstracting, doing exactly what Dr. Haney says here. We know it all, and even though our eyes have told us something, we don't accept that. We know better. Caucasians don't use razors, you know, against people. We know that. That's a fact. So what is being communicated to us, that doesn't make sense to us. And so we block it out. Boy, talk about stereotyping and prejudice. That's one of the things that we tried to indicate to officers in the academy. Hey, you guys are coming here with prejudices. We're going to have to cope with them. We're going to have to recognize we have prejudices. We're going to have to deal with them. We're going to have to do our best to eliminate them. Principles of communications. We've talked about problems. Now, how do we solve all these problems? You might think, how in the world do we get thoughts from brain to brain with all these problems? Here's one. Be a good listener. Let's turn in our Bibles. I'm going to have the living again with me tonight. Two principles for solving communication problems. It's always good to look to God's Word. Proverbs 12:15. A fool thinks he needs no advice, but a wise man, in other words, a man who is following the principles of God, a wise man listens to others. You know, I think the probably the art that has been lost, that most of us years ago, not us in this room, but most of us, speaking of human beings, really had developed on a better basis, is the art of listening. Everything is kind of done for us today, you know. We have pictures to now go along with words. We watch television, and so we're not used to listening. We're used to seeing it all done. Nothing's left to our imagination. Nothing's left for us to interpret because of pictures. You do much better by communicating by pictures. But we're lazy listeners today, and we've lost the art of listening. The art of listening involves several things, but before we go to that, let's look at another verse, Proverbs 18:13, which adds a little bit more light to this fact of listening. What a shame, yes, how stupid to decide before knowing the facts. Be a good listener. Try to, point number one here, try to get inside the speaker. Try to appreciate where they're coming from. If you're talking to a teenager who is on a high school campus, try to recognize the fact that you're talking with a person that comes from a high school campus. Try to, as best you can, remember what it was like when you were on the high school campus, and more so than that, realize the realities of life today on the high school campus. And so when you talk to a person today that lives on a high school campus, it's important to know a little bit about that high school campus, and how are you going to know unless you listen to them tell you about it? Be a good listener. Try to get inside the speaker. Grasp from his or her point of view. And really, that's what the word empathy means. What it really means is try to grasp from the other person's point of view what they're talking about. Don't try to see it from your point of view. You can always see that automatically. But try to see it from his or her point of view. What is that person really trying to communicate? Consciously think, when someone is talking to you, where are they coming from? What are they trying to communicate to me? How would I view it if I viewed it from her or his perspective? Number two, listen for total meaning. Listen to the content.
Please turn your tape to side two.
Try to pick up on feelings that are being communicated by the person. Look at their face. Someone came up to me at the break and said, my little boy or girl, I forget which, they said they come up and they continue to say, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. And they won't start talking until I look at them or until I recognize them and say, yes. You ever have that little one come up and keep on poking you? You know, and you feel it's poking and it kind of bugs you. But what they want you to do is look to them and give them your undivided attention. And you know, in listening to words, when we have so many problems in communication, you need to look at people when they talk. You need to look at the expression on their face. You need to try to get the total meaning, the feeling included. Here's probably the most important principle I can give you in being a good listener. Test for understanding. This is something that I try all the time. And to try to test for understanding, one of the best ways is to repeat what they've said in another phrase of words. Let me give you an example. One of the common traits of women, some of you guys said, are you going to talk about husband-wife relationships? I really am. This is one of the nights. We're talking about communication. All of these principles apply to you and your wife. As you know, the big three of marriage breakups is probably led by number one, communication. They all involve communication, breakdown in communication. But this business of testing for understanding, quite often, women begin, and all people begin, not just women, but women begin by sending out what they call psychological feelers. They make a statement, or they ask a question, and what they're really trying to find out is, are you ready to listen to me? And so as you walk in the door at night, they'll make a statement. For instance, they'll say, boy, do I have a headache. And then they watch you. Now, just like this young boy, they've got something really in mind they're trying to get from you. They're trying to wonder, they're asking really, are you ready to listen to my problems? And what they really want you to say when they say, have I got a headache, they want you to say, oh, you got a headache. Why you got a headache? You getting a cold? No, I'm not getting a cold, but man, do I have a headache. Well, did something happen? Ah, now you've said, hey, I'm ready to listen to your problems. And then they'll start to communicate. They'll start telling you why they have the headache. They really don't want you to know if they have a headache. They want you to know about some problems they face that day. And this is one way for them to begin asking you your advice or counsel or get some sympathy from you by making a statement, I've got a headache. That's called a psychological feeler. Be very much aware of those. When people say things to you, when they ask questions of you, try to look beyond the question, try to look beyond the statement by testing to see if you understand what they really mean. Next time your wife makes a statement, I've got a headache, go a little further than that. Find out why she said that. He says, I usually tell her to take a couple aspirin. You know, that's one way of saying, I don't want to talk right now. And you know, the best way to tell them you don't want to talk, and you've all done this, you know, she says, I've got a headache. And you say, you've got a headache. I got a neck ache, a back ache, a headache, and a stomach ache, you know. And what you're really saying is not that you've got all those aches. What you're really saying is my problems are bigger than your problems. See? And I don't want to mess around with your little problems. I got some biggies. Psychological feelers. Test. One of the most important things we covered tonight. Test for meaning. Rephrase the statement or the question and see if they really want to talk about something. Demonstrate an interest. I think one of the best ways of demonstrating an interest is to do something with the person that they like to do. And this isn't always possible because of time constraints, but demonstrating an interest may be just going and sitting down alongside them and looking at them. One of the ways I demonstrate an interest in my son, his bedroom is on the second floor of our house, and my bedroom's on the main floor. And just walking up the stairs, when he's in his room, kind of getting ready to go to bed or whatever, just going up and sitting on the floor next to his bed or on the edge of his bed, I'm telling him, hey, Bob, I'm interested in you. I've come upstairs. You know, I don't have to say that. Just the fact that I'm there. I'm saying, hey, I'm interested in you. I'm willing to spend some time up here. You got anything to talk about? You know, I don't have to say that. I just being there, that says, hey, I'm interested. When he was younger, he used to love to play basketball. And I put a ring up for him out above the garage. And he knew that I really didn't dig basketball that much. I never played basketball in high school. Football was my game. I wasn't too interested in basketball. And he knew that when I went out and played basketball with him, that I really was interested in him, because he knew that although I knew he was interested, he knew I didn't have much interest. And so when I'd come home, I'd get out of the car. I'd say, hi, Bob, how are things? Oh, they're all right. As I'm walking to the door, anything happened today interesting? No? And then I get in the house. I change clothes. And I get on my grubbies and I say, hey, before dinner, how about a game of horse? Oh, yeah, you know. We go out in the back room, or rather the backyard, and we start, you know, shooting the basket. You've played horse before. And, you know, you're playing this game and throwing in the buckets, you know, and about 15 minutes into the game, the same kid who 20 minutes earlier said nothing happened today, you know, says, just as you're shooting, you know, got in a fight today. And you missed the whole backboard, you know. And then he tells you about knocking a kid over the seat of the bus, breaking the window, and tearing a kid's coat. And it's kind of nice to know, you know, because you're going to get a phone call from an angry parent. But he didn't say that when I got home and asked him anything interesting happened today. But he says that when we're playing basketball with him, because he knows that I'm interested in him, because I'm there doing something with him that he likes. I demonstrate an interest. And he says, hey, you know, the old man's out here, just me and him, he's ready to listen to me. That's really neat. Establish a habit pattern. A friend of mine, Dr. Ralph Byron, chief surgeon at City of Hope Hospital, very busy man. So busy that time management, as far as he is concerned, is a real big problem. Dr. Byron said, it's important for me to establish communication patterns in order to get it done. You know, I just can't let it go by itself. I have to establish patterns. And he said, one little gimmick I use, Bob, that you may want to use. We talk about time management because I have problems with time management too. He said, one of the things I do is I have a chair. It's a rocking chair, and I call that my communication chair. And I tell Dorothy, that's his wife, when I'm sitting in that chair, that means I want to communicate, and I'm ready to listen to you, and, you know, anything you want to talk about, I'm ready. If I go sit in the easy chair over there, I'm not ready yet. You know, I want to unwind just a little bit from surgery, but as soon as I move over to that chair, I'm ready. And he says, yeah, just watch her. You know, she's watching me. She's in there fixing dinner, and she's watching, you know. As soon as he moves over, she descends on him like a vulture and starts laying things on him, you know. It's kind of a conditioned reflex almost that she knows that when he's in that chair, she's ready to communicate. And you know, it's important to establish communication patterns for a number of reasons. Let me give you one example. I don't like to talk about heavy things just before I go to sleep. Because if I talk about something kind of heavy, I don't sleep too well. You know, I think about it all night. Maybe some of you don't have that problem, but I will. If it's something real heavy, just before I go to sleep, I'll sleep kind of light. Some people even have trouble going to sleep if you lay something heavy on them just before they go to sleep. And I didn't realize it for a while, but, you know, Esther, I'd come home from something like this, and, you know, I'd get in the bedroom and start getting ready for bed, you know, and she'd start laying some heavies on me, and man, I'd turn her off just real quickly. You know, I wasn't so much conscious of it, but all of a sudden I start realizing, hey, I'm violating all of the principles that I teach. I'm turning her off. And then I realized why I was turning her off. It wasn't good for me to talk about heavy things before I go to bed. And so I shared that with her. I said, hey, honey, I really don't like to talk about heavy things before I go to bed. But let me give you some other times during the day that we always have every day that where we can talk. Now, since I have an unusual job as far as not being able to tell for sure when I'm going to get home at night, I don't always come home at the same time. Some of you do. Some of you always get home at 5. Sometimes I get home at 5. Sometimes I get home at 7. It's right usually between those 2 hours. And she's real kind. You know, she doesn't get bugged if she has dinner ready at 5 and I don't get in there till 7. She keeps it warm and tries to keep it from drying out, you know. But she's always kind of waiting. And as a result, dinner isn't sitting on the table when I get home. And so there's always around 15 minutes from the time I walk in the door until I sit down and eat. And so what I do, I have a little pattern. I walk in and we have a breakfast bar right by the island where she cuts things on a chopping board, you know, and gets things all ready, salad and all that. So I'll take off my coat, and I'll sit at the bar, and I've told her, this is my communication center right here. You know, when I sit here, I'm ready to listen to you, you know, while you're getting things together here. And that's one time we can talk. And I've given her a couple other times during the day when we can talk. But that's one where I'm always ready. And so we have a little pattern. You know, I come in, walk in, I take off my coat, I sit up there, she's getting salad cut and all that. Oh, let me tell you about this, you know, and this little deal here, and so and so, they want to come over and spend a weekend with us here, you know, what do you think about that? And she has a counter laid out there on the bar ready for me, you know, and I mark things, yeah, okay, we'll do that. And I handle all kind of home business during about 15 minutes before dinner. It's a regular pattern. We do that. And I think it's important for you to establish habit patterns with your wives, with your children. Establish habit patterns. I had a weird habit pattern with my children that it was kind of Mickey Mouse, you might think, but it really worked. And that is, when they were real young, I used to play a game with them. It was called Answer Man. Every Tuesday and Thursday night. It was a habit pattern. When they were just little kids, I said, on Tuesday and Thursday night, we're going to play this game called Answer Man. When I come up to your room on Tuesday and Thursday night to listen to your prayer, it's more than just to listen to your prayer. I'm ready to answer any question you have. And they used to enjoy that game. You know, I'd come up, and they, at that time, they were both in the same room. You know, just little kids, you know. And I'd come up there, and they'd say, it's Tuesday night, it's Answer Man. You know, and they had maybe four questions each. And some of them were weird questions, you know. How does God make snow? That's a heavy, you know. And what makes wheels go round? You know, all kind of things like that that are hard to answer. That sounds so simple, but you try to answer that question, you know. And why is the sky blue? You know, and wow, some heavies. And we had just a great time playing Answer Man. It was a game for them. And they tried to outdo one another with questions, you know. Well, it became very natural. Then in the evolution of things, as far as time is concerned, when it went on, when they got older, they had been asking me questions on Tuesday and Thursday night all their lives, all their known lives. And when they got up to the time of going through the pubes, you know, when they were kind of getting interesting and knowing what's going on in life and all that, it became very natural for them to ask me questions, for instance, about sex. It was a natural thing. They asked Daddy for questions on Tuesday and Thursday nights all their life. So what's more natural than to ask this kind of a question? There was a habit pattern, a reflex almost action that was built up, and it really worked. Establishing a habit pattern is an important thing. Proverbs 13:5, the next big principle here is not only be a good listener, but be honest. Proverbs 13:5. A good man hates lies, wicked men lie constantly and come to shame. One thing that will really inhibit communications is people who are known as untrue communicators. You know, they cannot be relied upon. Actually, people appreciate frankness. Proverbs 28:23. In the end, people appreciate frankness more than flattery. That's what the Bible says. Now, that has to be tempered with not only speaking frankly, but it says the words of the wise man are soothing. And you know, you can be frank without being cutting. There's a difference. I don't really believe in the type of what they call sensitivity training where you really get cutting, you know, and you just slice people apart. I attended a sensitivity session during my master's program where we were locked up for a weekend together, you know. And we didn't do any of that stuff about taking off clothes or anything like that. But we sat around in a group, and I noticed something had happened. They dog-packed each individual over that weekend at one point or another. At one point or another, one guy was kind of the victim, and the whole group just tore him in pieces, you know. And there was one, a gal that was there, who just couldn't take it. She just came to pieces, and they had to get her out of there. She couldn't take it. I don't think that's what the Bible's talking about here. In fact, I know it's not what the Bible's talking about. It's talking about being open, but it balances it out, and we have a verse that we'll get to later on that talks about the type of frankness it's speaking of here is a type that heals and that's soothing, not cutting. It's not the kind that is critical for the sake of being critical, but it's the type that heals and that is helpful. Reliable communication permits progress, and that's exactly what it says in Proverbs 13:17. You won't be able to really make progress if you don't have good communications coming across. You won't be able to make progress with your children if they're afraid to talk to you because you've shut them off. The Bible says in Proverbs 26:28, that flattery is a form of hatred. Ever think of that? Proverbs 26, 28. Flattery is a form of hatred and wounds cruelly. You know, when you flatter somebody, and by the way, Webster defines flattery as venial praise. In other words, venial, you have a reason. It's a subversive type of praise. You're patting them on the back as you're slipping a knife in the other side. You know, you're trying to get something from them. The Bible says that's wrong. You shouldn't flatter people. But you see, this concept of being honest that we've just gone through is counterbalanced with the next great principle, and that is to be constructive. Never be cutting or damaging. Proverbs 12:18. Let's turn over there. Some people like to make cutting remarks, but the words of the wise, in other words, remember how we identified wise? A man who is following God's pattern. But the words of the wise soothe and heal. I saw in a management book just a couple of weeks ago the definition of how to be really constructive in your criticism. And that was the true test of constructive criticism. This is just the way it said it. The true test of constructive criticism is to leave the person with a feeling that he's been helped. And so as you walk away after criticizing someone, if they are thanking you and honestly feeling, hey, this guy is a friend. He helped me. I'm going to be a better person because of what he said. Then you're using the biblical principle of being honest. You're honest, but you're doing it in a soothing way. I think that the session that I referred to that I attend typified by the first portion of Proverbs 12:18. Some people like to make cutting remarks. I saw people there who were enjoying just chopping people, just seeing how they could hurt. When you walked into this room, I said to myself, I hate that guy. I don't like the way you comb your hair. I don't like the way you smile. I don't like this, and boom, boom, just chop, chop. And you see the guy just, you know, getting destroyed emotionally by this person who is not being constructive. They're just tearing down for tearing down's sake. The Bible says that's not what we mean when we talk about being honest. Be honest, but be constructive. Phrase negatives in a positive way. You know what's possible? It's actually positive, it's possible to tell someone something and try to rid them of some negative things by putting in a positive way. For instance, telling someone, patting them on the back, and if you can say this honestly, you know, like your son, you see some progress, and you see that he's more willing to follow directions in doing such menial tasks like taking out the trash. Just to let him know, hey Bob, you know, I've noticed that you've made some improvement in following directions on such things as taking out the trash. Bob, I want to let you know you're really making some improvement there. You've got a ways to go, but you're a lot better than you were 2 months ago. You know, if you can honestly say that, that's good. That's letting him know you're not satisfied yet. You know, he's got some way to go, but you recognize the success that he has had. You've given him some security of saying, hey, I can do it. What I've done has been recognized. It's an encouragement. Be thoughtful. Really think of the other person before you tear them apart. One of the things that I'm going to be giving you near the end of this, not tonight, but near the end of our six-week session, is an exercise that I'm going to encourage you to go through with your wife. And it's an instrument for you to fill out together. And I want you to be very careful to utilize the principles we've talked about here tonight in filling out that instrument. To be open, to be honest, but to be constructive. Fourthly, encourage openness. Proverbs 15, 31, and 32. Some great principles. If you profit from constructive criticism, you will be elected to the wise men's hall of fame. But to reject criticism is to harm yourself and your own best interests. Boy, isn't that something? It really indicates that you're a great man when you're able to have openness and to accept criticism. Proverbs 23:12. There's another verse along the same lines. Don't refuse to accept criticism. Get all the help you can. Surface unpopular feelings. You know, the fact that you surface unpopular feelings, that's not creating unpopular feelings. That's just getting them out in the open where you can deal with them. You know, I've heard some parents talk with their children about something, and their son or their daughter will say, "If you could see this develop, why, you would have to worry about this war over there, Dad, and I don't want to hear that in my house, you know? I don't want to talk about that. You're wrong." And so the kid says to himself, "I won't talk about it in the house anymore," but that doesn't change his feelings. That doesn't give you the opportunity to have dialogue and understand one another. The feelings are there, except now they're seething underneath, you know, because he can't get them up. And it's like an iceberg floating along with 9/10 of it beneath the surface, waiting to hit your ship. You know, it's best to get that iceberg up on the surface where you can melt it, or at least deal with it. Maybe change some of your own attitudes. Very important to surface unpopular feelings. And that means that you're going to have to be a little tolerant on what you allow to be talked about. To shut off communications just because the communication doesn't agree with your value system. I'll give you an example about that. I was talking with my son here a couple of years ago, and he was just starting to listen to Elton John, you know. And I said, "Man, I don't want to hear about that anymore, and I don't want to talk to you about that. I really dislike his music, and I dislike what the words say, and that's it, and I don't want to talk about it. And I don't want to hear it in my house." Well, I may not hear it in my house, you know, but he's still listening to it, and he's still doing his thing when he can, you know, behind my back or whatever. And we didn't have a chance to get it out in the open, and I didn't get a chance to explain why. And I got thinking, once again, about some of the principles that I talk about. I said, "Vernon, you goofed. You know, you blew it. You shut him off. He'll never talk to you again unless somehow you can make amends." And I had to go back to him and say, "Hey, you know, I'm really sorry for blowing my cool. Let's talk about this. Let's wrap. Sure you won't get mad, Dad? You know? Yeah, I really won't get mad, Bob. Okay, let's talk about it." So we started talking. We talked. And I said, why don't you go get the album?" Some friend of his had given him an album, brought it home. So he brought it in. And I pointed out some words to him. And I said, you know what this means right here? You know what this is talking about?" I think I do. I never really looked at it like that before. It's talking about lesbians, isn't it?" "Yeah, it really is, Bob. You know, you want these words bombarding your mind over and over again? You really want this?" "I don't think so. I think you're right." And so he agreed, you know, we kind of come to a compromise. He agreed that there were certain songs by Elton John that he didn't want in his house. And I agreed that there were certain songs by Elton John that weren't bad, pretty good music. I kind of enjoyed it. And we came to a real good understanding. He understood why I disliked some of Elton John's music, and I also understood why he liked some of the other stuff. And it was good for us to get this out because, you know, if we hadn't surfaced those feelings, I'm convinced that today he would still be listening to those same bad words. And you know, one of the big things, you're talking about music. I'm getting off a little bit off the subject here, but talking about music, some people say, "Yeah, but I don't listen to the words. I just like the beat." You heard that before, Dad? They may not listen consciously, but did you ever hear of this concept of subliminal impact? You know, they conducted some tests in a theater, you probably heard about it, where they flashed, I forget what, whether it was Coke or Pepsi-Cola or something like that, but they... popcorn. They flashed the word popcorn and also a picture of a, you know, nice butter dripping down popcorn at something like a 90th of a second on the screen. And, you know, you couldn't actually visually see it. You could not see it. They didn't know they had seen it. But their mind had seen it. And popcorn sales, it was incredible the way popcorn sales went up. I forget the percentage point. But they proved a definite correlation when they flashed this on the screen subliminally. It had more impact than putting it up there visually. That's the weird thing. It got to the subconscious, which apparently influences us even more than the conscious. Wow, that's a heavy thought. And now, to have certain words and certain songs bombard us over and over again, subliminally, when we're not listening, when we're not consciously taking it in, is almost more dangerous than listening word for word. That's a weird thought. I don't fully understand it. But there's a principle there. But this matter of openness, of surfacing popular feelings so you can talk about them and so you can deal with them, is a very important thing. Try not to react negatively. Try not to be shocked. But try to get them out in the open where they can be dealt with, so that communication can take place. Okay, here's some of the application of some of these principles. I really believe in the concept of guidance. Of guidance. The definition that I've applied here for guidance is to show, to watch over, to lead, to influence conduct, to instruct. Prerequisites to guidance. Did we talk about these last week? Seems like I mentioned the four awares. Did I? The four awares, to be aware of whoever you're talking to and trying to guide, whether it be your wife, your son, your daughter. Be aware of their interests, their friends. This is especially true with young people. Their property and their time. How do they spend their time? What are they doing with their time? To be someone who can really exert guidance through communication, you have to know these four things. Seems like I related to you last week the story of the reflector, did I? Remember the story of the reflector? I didn't relate it. It really, to me, illustrates what I'm talking about here. My father was so familiar with me, my interests, my friends, my property, my time, that any change in any of those, and he was aware of it almost immediately. I brought home my bike one day, and on my bike, I had a new 15-cent reflector, just a little thing. My dad was so aware of my property that 2 or 3 days after I brought it home, he recognized the new reflector on the bike. Really? He said, "You got a new reflector on your bike?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Where'd you get it?" "I got it from Donald." He said, "Where did Donald get it?" I said, "He stole it." I was 7 years old, and to me, I was clean. I didn't steal it. He said, "You have a stolen reflector on your bike?" I said, "Dad, I didn't steal it. Donald stole it." And really, I thought I was clean. He said, "Yeah, but it's stolen." And I said, "Well, you know, I didn't tell him to steal it. He brought it to me after he stole it, so I had nothing to do with the theft of it." He said, "Well, don't you understand how wrong it is to have stolen property?" And I said, "No, sir. As long as I didn't steal it." He said, "Okay, come on out in the back." You know, and I thought, here we go. You know, because any time we went out back of the garage, there was an apricot tree there that he used to get switches off of. And I usually got it, you know. And this day, instead of getting the switch in, we sat on the orange crates there. And he said, "Now look, I really want to talk this over with you. Let's just talk about it." And we talked for at least 45 minutes. This is on my dad's day off. He was a cop. And he didn't get too many days off in those days. In those days, they got 5 days off a month. Now we get 9, you know, twice as much. But in those days, he only got 5 days off a month. So they were very important to him. And this was his day off. And he said, "Now look, the kid up the street, what's his name? The one that I'm always picking up." And I said, "Oh, Stanley. He comes and he rips you off for your reflector, all right?" I said, "Okay." He said, "No, wait a minute. Let me use something else. Your sheepskin seat." And I said, "Okay." And he takes that, and he gives it to your best buddy next door, Albert Casino. I said, "Oh, yeah, Albert." And Albert puts it on his bike. And a few days later, you notice that Albert, your buddy, has your sheepskin seat. And I said, "That dirty rat, you know." I'm mad at Albert, you know. He's no friend of mine if he'd do that. He said, "Why? He didn't steal it." "Ah, I'm starting to understand, see." And it took a long time for a little 7-year-old to really understand the whole concepts involved in property rights and you know, someone owning something and someone else taking it and receiving it from someone else, even though you didn't steal it. But by the end of that 40-minute talk, I really started understanding, and I was agreeing with him that it was wrong. And I felt badly about having this reflector. And I said, hey, I want to get it back to the guy that owns it. He said, well, how are you going to do that? I said, well, I don't know where Donald got it, but I'm going to give it back to Donald. So we got in the car. He drove me over to Homer Street, and I gave it to Donald. And amidst many laughs, you know, ah, you dummy, you know, you're bad as a cop, you can't do anything, you know, and all that. So I went back out to the car, and then we go down South Soda Street, and we end up out at Sears and Roebuck. And he takes me on the main floor, and he said, now, any reflector you want. And I went over, and I got a great big 50-cent one. And you see, he said, you have been honest, and you've done as much as you can to get it back to who it belongs to. And I want to let you know that I really appreciate you talking with me about this. And that's why I'm giving you this new reflector. Now, that's guidance. See? That's a lot different than rules. You know, he could have done this. He could have said, stolen property, receiving stolen property, 496 Penal Code section, you know. And, you know, get out the whip and give me a few and say, next time, this time it was 5 whips, right? Yes, sir. Next time, 10 whips. The rule around here is you do not keep stolen property. And I've understood that, you know, but I would have agreed with it. I would have thought, hey, this is wrong. I didn't steal it. I got whipped for doing something I didn't do. And I would have been angry with my dad. The Bible says in Ephesians 6, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath. See? And I would have been mad at him because I didn't understand what I had done wrong. And I would have been more careful next time. I wouldn't have copped out to begin with that I had something stolen, you know. If he'd asked me, where'd you get it? Well, I found it, you know, something like that. Or I'd have been more careful. But I would have agreed with him, and I would have been angry at him. So, really, I don't believe as much in rules as I do principles and understanding principles and communicating them, whether it be to your children or your wife, you know, to tell her, you're going to do this, honey. Why? Because I said so. Check out the Bible. I'm in charge here. You know, that's no way to handle it, man. There's got to be understanding. There's got to be communication and agreement with your children. There's got to be a lot of guidance. And you know why we resort to rules rather than guidance? You know why? Because it takes more time. It takes more time to give guidance. It took my dad the better part of his day. It took about 3.5 hours for him to give me that guidance about stolen property. The long talk, drive over to Donald's house, all the way down to Sears and Roebuck, talking all the way. My dad poured about 3.5 hours of his life into my little 7-year-old life. And you know what? What an impact it made. I've never forgotten. Guidance. Being aware of interests, friends, property, time. And of course, the factors involved in guidance, not the prerequisites only, but you've got to, once you understand those things, you have to be involved in a discussion of the principles. You just can't lay out a bunch of rules. Thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not. There has to be a discussion of the principles behind the rules and an application of the principles. You have to help them understand, just like, you know, Stanley up the street takes your thing, gives it to Albert. There was the application. And a reinforcement of the principles. The reinforcement, in this case, was a reward for going along with the whole action and giving me a 50-cent reflector. Now you're reinforced for doing the right thing. Here you are. Reward. And a follow-up later on. Make sure I really understand. And then a demonstration of the principle. And this is the most important thing. I agree with John MacArthur when he says the best way to lead is by example. The best way to lead is by example. That's right. You ever try to push a string? You can't do it. You got to drag it. And you know, a little life that's following you, you can't push them ahead of you. This whole matter of, for instance, vocabulary. You show me a young person who has a filthy mouth, and I'll show you, in most cases, a home where there's been a lot of profanity and abusive language in the home. You know, my son told me, He's 16 years old. He has no reason to lie to me. He says, "Dad, as far as I know, I've never sworn." And I, you know, this was gratuitous information. I didn't ask him. I didn't say, "Hey, have you ever sworn?" And of course, he has to come up with the right answer. You know, he volunteered this. He says, "Dad, as far as I know, I've never sworn, and I don't want it." We got to talk about that. And I said, "Well, that's really neat, Bob. I'm sure proud of you." He said, "You know what, Dad? I've never heard you swear. I've never heard Mom swear." Now, I realized, wow, how important. But you know, just to balance that out, I don't want you to think Mr. Clean here, you know, never made a mistake. I've seen my son do some things that are wrong. As I've looked in my life, usually the reason he's done that is he's seen me do it. Well, you lead by example. You lead by demonstrating the principle in your own life. That's kind of a heavy thought because it's so hard to be the kind of example we should be. Gentlemen, it's impossible. We need some outside help. That's what Christianity is all about. That's what having Christ in your life is all about. Giving you the strength to be able to carry out this guidance. Okay, rules and judgment. Talking about rules, we should have rules, but you can minimize rules by having a lot of principles. I like to put it this way. I think that the rules we have, that the few rules we have, especially when a child is young, that the rules should be very firm. And sometime when they're young, they can't understand yet the principle. You try your best when they're young to explain the principle, but they always won't get the principle, and so you have to resort to a rule. And there's two theories about rules. Some people say you make the rules pretty restrictive. And other people say you make the rules pretty broad. You allow the person a little opportunity to move around. The problem with making them too narrow is you have to make exceptions a lot. You have to say, well, except in this case, and 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 this case. When you make your rules too constrictive, you have to make a lot of exceptions. And that's a bad principle. I believe in having the rules quite flexible as far as being far away, but inflexible as far as having a bunch of exceptions. I think it's important to have your rules, your guidance for their lifestyle and everything, broad enough so that they have some opportunity to move around in. But man, when they step over that line, they know it's there. There's no holes in that line. When they step over the line, kavoom, you know, something happens. And they realize, hey, the line is really there. We used to have a correctional school in Los Angeles called Reese, R-I-I-S, Jacob Reese. Some of you remember that school. If you had a problem at school, you know, and you got kicked out of your school, expelled, they'd send you to Jacob Reese, downtown at 76th and Broadway. And I remember as a juvenile officer going into Reese to pick up some kids that had robbed a RTD bus man of his money and his watch. And he didn't care too much about the money, but he had a railroad watch like I carry here. This belongs to my grandpa. And he had a similar one. It was real neat, you know, had a lot of thoughts with it. He said, "I really like that watch back." And so I went into the principal and I said, "Mr. Vandreff, they not only got some money, they got some this guy's watch, and I really like to know where that watch is." And he brought him in. He said, "Where's the watch?" The guy says, "What watch, man?" He said, "Hey, you know my rules around here, right? When I tell you that I'm going to do something, do I ever follow through? Fail to follow through?" He said, No, you don't, Mr. Van. "Where's the watch?" "It's out in the alley, sir." You know, boom, it came right up. He didn't have to do anything. But I found out why. Because I was there at many other occasions. And when I was there one time, I forget what kind of business, he brought in a lad into his office, and the assistant to the principal had a list of names here and some guys, and he brought in this one lad, and he said, "Three for him." And Van said, "Okay." Reached down and grabbed the handles, and next to the floor were some handles bolted to the wall, about that far from the floor. And the guy reached over, and he kind of looked back, you know, and he reached down and he got a hold of those. Vandreff went over to his desk and got out a belt about this wide, doubled like that, and he kind of hop, skip, and a jump, and wham, he let on this guy, and the guy straight up, you know, on his toes, and he walked around a little bit. He says, go on down. He says, remember, three. And he said, yes, sir, Mr. Van. He went down, whack, you know, and he ended up getting three. And he said, now, look, Joe, what did I tell you when you were in here the other day? Well, when I was in here yesterday, I was late, and you gave me two, and you said if I'm late tomorrow, I get three. That's right. You were late today, right? Yes, sir. How many did you just get? Three? That's right. Guess what happens if you're late tomorrow? Whatever you say, I'll get. You know, the guy knew by that time, but when he said something, he meant it. He said, now, I want to ask you a question. You wouldn't tell me this the other day, but I think there's a reason you're late. You're not telling me. What's the reason? The guy shuffled around. Got tears in his eyes. He hadn't teared up when he was getting hit, but he got tears now. And he said, because we don't have a clock, that's why. Vander said, hey, called in his aide. He said, put him on the list. The guy walked out of the office, and I said, what list? He said, oh, it's the guys I wake up in the morning. I said, what? And his aide says, you know what this clown does? Points to the principal. In his own car, with his own gas, he wakes up about 35 guys every morning. 35 guys whose parents won't either get a clock or won't wake them up. He helps them get to school on time. I thought, wow, what a balance. You know? Firmness underscored with a foundation of love. Firmness underscored with a foundation of love. That guy loved those guys so much that he himself, in his own car, in his own time, with his own gas, would wake them up in the morning. And rules? Yeah, firm rules. But broad rules, flexible enough, you don't have to make a lot of exceptions. You know, one thing that I noticed at Jacob Riis High School, I saw a lot of kids go there very emotionally disturbed, very antisocial in their behavior, and after they were there for a while, kind of a feeling of serenity and peace would suddenly come about them. And they started recognizing that there really are boundaries. And you know what I think they were doing before they went there? They kept on walking out to see, where's that boundary really at? And since they never find it, they keep on going. They got there and they found out, hey, there are boundaries. They're not unreasonable. They don't box you in. But they're really there. They don't have all these loopholes. And this is especially true when people are growing up, when they're young, when they always don't understand the principles. You're going to find out when we get into our study on discipline that there are also some principles on preparing for freedom, and you begin doing that when they're around 3 years old. You know, you begin preparing them for freedom because someday, eventually, they've got to be on their own. Censorship, we already talked about that. The onion theory, I mentioned that to you. Layer upon layer, experience upon experience. So we must be very careful what kind of experiences we put into that great computer that God has given us. The GIGO principle. You know what GIGO stands for in computer talk? Garbage in, garbage out. Whatever you put into the computer comes out. So don't blame the computer. It just puts out what you put in. You put bad junk in there, bad junk will come out. Our minds are very much like that. The Bible says in Matthew 15:18-20, what a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. You know, the kind of thoughts that go into your mind, programs your mind. That's what you turn out being. That's how you begin to act. Your thoughts become acted out. So we have to be careful, and as leaders of our home, we have to censor what happens, the kind of garbage that comes in. We talked a little bit earlier about subliminal impact. That's below the conscious level. Very dangerous. There's constant bombardment subliminally in life today. We live in a very hostile environment. Well, communication. Very important thing. Probably the cause of most misunderstandings and inability to get along, and some principles from God's Word to live by. See you next week.